Between 1936 and 1939, Nazi Germany operated the third largest whaling fleet in the world. Its giant processing ships roamed the Antarctic, almost driving the blue whale to extinction, all to make one vital product, margarine. Hello, my name is Gareth Edwards, and welcome to the Untitled History Podcast. Join me each week alongside world-leading experts as we take a deep dive into your favorite topics from throughout history. From the ancient world to the modern, and with plenty of historical rabbit holes in between, we'll cover famous and not-so-famous moments in history from all across the globe. Nazi Germany was not the only nation to take up whaling on an industrial scale. In the 1930s, Great Britain and Germany brought almost 85% of all whale oil in the world. The Nazi obsession with national self-sufficiency, though, led them to become one of the top whaling nations in just a few short years. It also created a Nazi strategic obsession with Antarctica that continues to fuel conspiracy theories today. This is what we're going to be talking about on this show, and I'm joined for this by my good friend, Dr. Alex Clark. Say hello, Alex.
Hello.
So, for those unfamiliar, Dr. Clark is a naval historian. He is the author of Tribals, Battles, and Darings, and he specializes in grand strategy, naval logistics, and the projection of overseas power. And he can also be found on Twitch and YouTube as Dr. Alex Clark with an E on the end. So, Alex, whaling, that's our topic for today.
I feel I should also add in that I'm a close enough friend of yours and sufficiently geeky that you know you can message me about certain topics and go, are you free and can you talk about this? And you know the answer before you even ask is going to be, yes, I can. Yeah, whaling is fun. Whaling is one of those things which is really important because of margarine, because of that, the fats for food. But also it's the lubricants it gives for operating aircraft at very high altitudes, if you want to have them doing that. It's vehicles. During World War II, there's this stuff called automatic transmission fluid, which is this lovely stuff which is really useful for Jeeps and keeping them going. And that comes from whale oil. The amount of things which are named so you don't realize there's whale oil in them. But yeah, whale oil is important, especially as we weren't really that capable yet in our adaptions of petroleum products. So we needed the whale oil. We needed its capabilities. We needed its properties to really be able to achieve the things we want to achieve. And this was a big thing for Germany during World War II, their lack of it. And it's one of the reasons why the British were quite so keen on nabbing Norwegian whalers and Norwegian refrigerated ships whenever they could find them. The tribal class destroyers had a lot of fun doing that at various operations. But, you know, the reason the British were taking them away from the Germans and so keen on them and they were so valued was because A, the British might make use of them themselves, but B, and this was always more interesting, it stopped the Germans having access to them.
So let's talk about why whale oil becomes this huge industrial product, because you've touched on many of the uses there, and they're both sort of civilian and military.
Yeah.
And listeners, if you're thinking when we talk about whaling of, like, you know, Captain Ahab on a single ship hunting down a big whale, that is, of course, how the industry is in that era, in the Victorian era and all beyond. But as Alex said, the creation of machinery and aircraft that need that high-quality oil, the creation of margarine, and we'll talk a bit more about how margarine exploded into use everywhere in a second, is what drives this industrial demand for it. And that's what kicks in properly in the late 1920s. It then arrives in the 1930s. And to set the scene a bit, as you head towards sort of, let's say, 1930 and into 1931, 32, the biggest issue that people are facing in terms of supply is that there's a real lack of animal fat, and animal fat is critical to various products. It's critical for making things like margarine, which is a useful butter substitute, and it's critical for other related oil products. And as the Great Depression kicks in, many, many nations, their farming industries collapse. They look more inwardly in terms of what they're doing. There's a crisis of availability of foreign currency. And all this means that everyone is hunting around for a new source of high quality oil. And this is what brings that whaling industry right back into operation again. And the key players in this are Norway, Britain, and Germany, with Japan as well, but Japan's sort of operating in a different sphere from everyone else. But those are the four giant industrial powers that bring the full force of industrialization to hunting whales. And this hunting is primarily happening in the Antarctic, because by this point, whales have almost been driven to extinction in northern waters already by overfishing and whaling. And so the Antarctic is seen as this fresh territory that they can start to hunt in, isn't it?
That was the trouble, the perception, though. A lot of them perceived the sea as this untapped resource, as this thing which they could go and there would be limitless resources. They could turn it into a new German colony, was, I think, Goering's favourite phrase on the subject. But he has so many fun phrases. Goering is one of those people like Churchill who has a quote for everything. But unlike Churchill, doesn't do much. Apart from cause trouble. Churchill causes plenty of trouble, but he also does quite a lot as well. So, you know, that's where it balances out. But the thing is, with all this stuff, all this mechanization, it's also looking for jobs as well. And that's the thing. If you're talking about a fishing fleet going out, and even in the Victorian times, they used to hunt in pairs or threes of ships. They'd have two or three of them because whales were so heavy. They needed the extra support to be able to get the whale in, especially the largest whales. When you're going to Antarctica, when you're going down that far, you need a factory ship, which is going to process everything. You'll need hunter ships. And the factory ship can process a whale an hour. It's going to take you more than an hour to capture a whale. So, and you're going to have two or three ships doing it. So you end up with fleets of 12 or even more hunter ships with every whaler ship, with every factory ship. And it's a massive operation. We're talking hundreds and hundreds of people. We're talking organization. If you consider South Georgia, okay, this little island in the South Atlantic Britain has, for many years in the 20s and 30s and 40s, it's one of the richest places on Earth. The reason it's so rich is because of all the whaling ships going through it and stopping off there, and it being the last point where they could really get resupply and where they could find spare components. Because the amount of things which would break. Because, again, a whale is heavy, and it breaks stuff when you're pulling it on, when you're getting it aboard. It breaks your crane, it breaks your components. You carry spares, but you never have enough spares, especially if you have to be down there for months at a time to pick up enough. And you're bringing back hundreds of tons of oil. And often you'll have oilers actually going out there, retrieving the oil from the factory ships and then coming home while the factory ship stays down there. And so this adds another level to the dimension. And it's a logistical operation. It's one of the interesting things. When we start talking about German logistics in World War II, we start looking at their radar logistics. A lot of those plans for their raiders comes from operating their whaling fleets, because that's how they used to do it. They used to go, okay, we're going to have these logistic ships here and here. You know they're going to be there. You can do your whaling duties, and then you can know you're going to have resupply here on a certain date. This is where it's going to be. Because also, and this is the other fun thing, not a lot of these ships carried radios. Not all of them had a lot of them had long-range radios. And even if they did, those radios would sometimes break in the cold. What is often forgotten about machinery is it really doesn't like cold weather. And the machines break before the people do. At certain points, even before the First World War, the Germans had been obsessed with going down to the Antarctic. They'd been the Filtner expedition, and I always want to call it the Gauss expedition, but I know that's the wrong name. I think it's the Glaski?
Yeah, Gauss works as well. They both work for it.
But those expeditions, because they knew the importance of whale oil. Whale oil wasn't something which suddenly became important in the 1920s and 30s. It had been ongoing importance before then, but it explodes importance. And that's the thing. It was really important to the arms industry prior to World War I, and was critical during World War I for the arms industry because, again, it's the lubricants, but it's also the things you can put on fine parts. One of the things that comes up a lot is people go, oh, it's very good for clockwork parts. Okay, what's clockwork also the same as? Fuses in bombs and fuses in shells. And, oh, it's the same things and the same stuff helps them. But German supply, you know, it just expands. The share of imports, I think, is in terms of their imports of whale oil, etc., goes up to, is it 52%?
That's it. You're basically looking at from sort of 1930s onwards, as you say, that like Germany has always been incredibly reliant on imports of whale oil. And yeah, it's above 50% in 1952. It's above 50% in 1932. Yeah. When they're doing that, and it remains that way, at least over 40% until about 1936. And actually, this becomes a key part of Hitler's sort of 4-year economic plan that he puts forward. It's he's like, look, we need our own fleets. We need to be self-sufficient in whale oil. We can't keep buying off of the Norwegians. you know, that's not a long-term strategy.
And that affects their actual ship production, because the same yards which could be used to build destroyers and torpedo boats has to be used to build whaling ships, which is a different use of those yards. One of the things you also have to remember is that they have to do a lot of their work through the Unilever Corporation, which of course is British and Dutch. And the reason they have to work through them is most of the prime whaling grounds that are known about in the South Atlantic and the Antarctic are British, under sort of British control. So they don't, I think it's the majority, is it 4 or 5 of their fleets?
Yeah, I mean, effectively to give listeners you an idea of what we're talking about when we talk about a whaling fleet here, as Alex mentioned earlier, what you're generally having is what's called a mothership. So it's a large sort of industrial processing factory. This will literally process 90% of the whale into useful goods whilst it's at sea.
Yeah.
And around them, you've got floating these smaller ships, what they call these hunters or whalers, and they will be going out. They will hunt the whale. They will kill the whale. And then they effectively tow it back to the ship. And generally, a fleet will be composed of somewhere between. So the Germans tended to operate a mothership, and that mothership would then have attached to it somewhere between 7 to 10 whalers that would go out and do things on average. And Unilever was one of the big companies that ran all of this. And again, the reason for them, for particular for being interested in this, was margarine, because margarine had become this butter substitute for so many in the world, particularly post-depression. And the discovery that you could do something called, hydroxinate?
Yeah, hydroxination.
Hydroxination is this process by which you effectively remove the fishiness from whale oil. And the moment people were able to do that, suddenly whale oil could be used in margarine in a way that it hadn't been before. And that opens up the opportunity for incredible levels of corporate whaling. Unilever are one of the big drivers of that. They also work closely with the German government in the period, because it's one way they can make sure that their money that they're investing into Germany, which they're not allowed to withdraw from Germany because of regulations on removing foreign currency, first under Weimar and later under the Nazis, it means that they can sort of reinvest that money back. They can still make their corporate products, but they can do it by expanding and building whaling fleets, which they then jointly operate with the Germans. So in total, throughout this period, and the real peak of this for the Germans is about 1936 onwards, you've got three key companies that are operating Germany whaling fleets. You've got Unilever, which, as you said, Alex, is operating, I think, about 7 fleets at the time. 4 of those are fleets licensed off of the Norwegians, and 3 of those are fleets that they have built in Germany and are operating themselves using the German maritime building, as you've said. The other two companies it's just worth mentioning before we move on are Henkel, which is a very large German soap manufacturer primarily, because the other thing you can make out of whale oil is soap, and a company called Walter Rau. Walter Rau were another huge margarine company in Germany, and chemical company in general. So they were also producing, as Alex said earlier, these side products are going to becoming useful oils for use in production, for use in aircraft and everything else. So these are the three companies that are primarily involved in this. They're operating in cooperation with the German state, with the British state as well, in the case of Unilever. And they're the people who are operating these huge industrial fleets that are sailing down to Antarctica from the summer of 1936 onwards and indulging in this mass harvesting of whales.
And it's important for them to do this because without them, their rearmament program goes to pot, their industrialization program goes to pot, and their food program goes to pot. And I tend to give examples when I'm trying to explain things in terms of history. It's like when I want to talk about the difference between German communist revolutionaries and the rest of Europe, there's the fact that their most famous shout when they were trying to storm a station was A, don't walk on the grass, and B, everyone bought a ticket before they stormed the platform. And that makes them a very different kind of revolutionary. When we're talking about how important whale oil and margarine is to the German economy, the German economy at some points was so obsessed with oil for fats from food that they wanted people to use metal spoons for cooking rather than wooden spoons, because it was felt the wooden spoon would soak in too much fat. This is at a time when they are very short of metal. They are even shorter of fat. And this just tells its importance and how valuable it was, because that's what they were focusing on. They were focusing on the fat shortage, that we need the fat.
I mean, it even gets its own name. It's called, I'm terrible at German. It's like the Fettlück. It's the fat gap. And it's an active part of Nazi propaganda and messaging and economic messaging is we need to close the fat gap. We can't be in a situation like we were in the Allied blockade in World War One, where we can't get this material again. We need to get it now. And we need to get it now because actually the other big thing that whale oil is good at is it stores really well. So if you can store up enormous quantities of whale oil and you're then going into a war, it's a useful strategic reserve. And the Germans aren't the only one that does this. The British declare it a strategic resource as well. But for Germany, it becomes seen as almost a life and death thing is to make sure that in the coming war, and obviously at the time, that's not how, in 36, that's not how Hitler's selling it to the public, he's selling it as a self-sustainability thing. But behind the scenes, the Nazis are very clearly thinking, if we're going into a war, we need vast reserves of whale oil. And again, listeners, I really want to emphasize this. If you, in 1931, for example, Germany is not a whaling power. It is not even on the charts as a whaling nation. It's done some North Sea whaling in the past. It's done some Northern Ocean whaling, but that's faded off. The real, in between 1936 and 1938, it goes from being nowhere on the charts to being at times the third largest. It's in a race almost with the British to be who is third and who is fourth. But that's the scale of whaling. We're talking, 15,000 whales, I think, in 1937 alone that the Germans pull out of the water. And they're mostly blue whales and fin whales, these giant whales in the Antarctic. Like, this is, as Alex says, this is up there with armaments. This is what they're really, really, really focused on.
And it's also one of the areas which can cause the most diplomatic issues. Because they are competing with other powers for whom it's just as important for. It's just as critical. And that's one of the problems for the Germans. And one of the reasons they actually give for things like the Graf Spee being where she is on her deployments prior to World War II, breaking out. Oh, she's down there as part of the security for the whaling fleet. She's down there as part of the force to protect that. Because that's important enough. And that's understandable. It's also one of the things that, they have to deal with, they have to constantly think about in the whaling season is the security of this force and what they're going to do. It actually becomes a bit of a strategic block on them in some regards because you don't want to upset certain nations in the whaling season because they will interrupt your whaling and they will stop you getting access to this fuel. And it is, whether it's fat or fuel or lubricant, whatever you want to call the various things which come out of it, it is essential. And each whale, I think it is, can produce up to 30 tons of all this stuff. Now, the one which is which I consider the most problematic is the whale meat. Because I know some people claim whale meat tastes like beef. I personally have never had it. I don't think Gareth's ever had it. The only person I know who's ever had it was my father, who was at a dinner in Japan, and he was served it and didn't realize what it was till he was asked about it, till he asked. And his description of it was a very slimy pork. He didn't like it at all.
It's whale meat's a really interesting one because I mentioned earlier that like the goal is to use everything that's on these that comes out of the whale.
The bones,
and that includes
used.
Yeah, bones. I forget the terms. Not the, what's the pseudo bone substance that you get out of whales.
Oh.
But all of that stuff effectively. Again, listeners, remember we're pre-plastic here.
Yeah.
And actually, whale bone and whale related products are a substitute for plastic in this era. So as Alex said earlier, like people are worried about metal spoons versus wooden spoons in terms of what you should use. Whalebone is being used for things like spoons, cutlery, but it's also being used for anything you might use plastic for today.
Corsets.
So everything is being used in this whale, from the whale, and that includes the meat. But there is a lot of cultural nuance around the use of whale meat and eating it. And to the point where even the Nazis, even though they briefly tried to push whale meat as an option for the public to eat, even they quickly realized that actually it's just not going to fly. And that's, again, a fascinating thing where it's down to how closely this is involved in the Nazi strategic operation and logistical operation, is the vast quantities of whale meat that these fleets that Unilever, that Walter Rau and Henkel are pulling in from their Antarctic voyages, all gets canned up, often on the ships themselves. They have entire canneries operating on these ships. And then it gets used actually in prison camps. it gets given to the army. A lot of those soldiers pushing into Russia later on are eating whale meat that was canned in 1936, you know, as if it's not bad enough that you're pushing into Russia. And yeah, you're having to do so fueled by whale meat, which is very nutritious. But as Alex said, it's not a thing you really want to be eating.
No, it's something which requires very careful preparation. That's what, going back to my father, he always said afterwards that the hosts were very annoyed as they didn't think it had been prepared properly. But that's it. His view was it tasted like a very slimy version, a very slimy, slightly fishy version of pork. And yeah.
Well, you mentioned earlier about the diplomacy of this. Yeah. And again, I think that's important to stress around this, because actually one of the nation that arguably has the biggest role to play in whaling across the board is the Norwegians. Yes. Norwegians had always been doing it. They were the masters of it. And actually, even the British and the German fleets that are sailing down to do whaling in the Antarctic are largely staffed by Norwegian crews.
Yes.
But the operation of the vessel, the processing plant, might be staffed by, say, German people in the case of the German fleets. But the people who are hunting the whales, the people who are firing the harpoon, the explosive harpoon guns, which is a very specialist job, are generally speaking Norwegians. And one of the big debates that actually happens about 1933, 1934, as Germany starts to think, should it get into this business, is, as you said, Alex, it's very delicate diplomatically, because they're to a certain extent reliant on the Norwegians agreeing to let them do it. Because if the Norwegians turn around and go, well, we're not going to support you in any way if you go whaling in Antarctica, you're not going to have the right crews. You're not going to be able to hire those extra fleets that the Norwegians have available. You're not going to have access to those things. And more importantly, the Norwegians who are supplying you already with whale oil are going to stick about 25% on the price of the whale oil they're selling you.
Oh, yes.
So it is really, really delicate diplomacy that the Nazi government has to do between about 1934 and 1936 to assure the Norwegians that there are enough whales to go around. I mean, there aren't. We know now that there weren't enough whales to go around. But it's that the persuading them to let them do this whaling. It's a weird, we think later in World War II terms of Germany rolling over Norway. In 1935, 1936, the shoe is on the other foot. The Germans are begging the Norwegians to let them go whaling and to be nice to them.
But actually, the power of that is one of the problems for Norway, because they perceive the whale oil as being so valuable, so powerful. And their cornerstone of these key people, so critical. They basically can dictate terms to the larger powers, and that's why they don't need to worry about the fence, because those countries can't get whale oil without us. And it's one of the things which actually leads them to them being steamrolled, is that there's part of them going, we have good relations with Germany, they depend on us for whale oil. Not really thinking, hang on, they're at war with Britain. They ain't getting whale oil under any circumstances. They have to get past the Royal Navy to get it. That ain't going to happen anymore. So we lose all our value completely. And this is the fun thing in some regards. We don't consider these things. And today, you know, when we start talking about this, you can't really sit there and go, well, there is a job like it where a nation has a corner on the entire market of these sort of skilled people. So everyone has to go cap in hand to them. There is no job like that. There is no country like that at the moment. But there was in the 1920s and 30s. It was Norway. And the British in return would let them use things like South Georgia, etc., and all these things to support them and assist them, and the Falkland Islands to support and assist them. And these were important areas. That was one of the reasons why these places were established and were kept British for so long, why the British were so keen on them. In the 20s and 30s, there would never have been any debate about anyone else getting their hands on the Falklands of South Georgia. If you move towards them, the Royal Navy would be mobilized en masse and would be down there to go, hello. So you want to have a conversation about this. We bring 16-inch guns and 15-inch guns and lots of aircraft. You're not going to enjoy the conversation. We will. So that was how important these areas were. And also, Norwegians were important because they were in many ways, how do I put this? They were the in-between us between the big powers. All the big powers could work through them, and it gave them diplomatic sort of, oh, we're not doing this agreement with the Germans. We're doing this agreement with the Norwegians. In fact, this is the Germans in the Royaling. Doesn't matter. Yeah, we're doing it with the Norwegians. And the Germans would go, oh, we're doing this with the Norwegians. Not the Brits. The Norwegians.
I find it really fascinating, as you say, because we often, we don't view, in inverted commas, consumer products as strategic resources these days. I mean, we probably are more so now due to recent events. But when most people consider what were the vital things in World War II and all that kind of thing, they think in terms of metals. They think in terms of, we talk about Sweden. One of the reasons Sweden holds out so well, and that's a podcast in the future talking about Swedish defense policy in World War II. But we all intrinsically understand that their access to rare materials is what largely keeps them safe. Portugal has the same thing with tungsten. But we just don't really think that for a long time, certainly in that interwar period, one of the big reasons Norway doesn't even think about doing a large-scale military buildup is, as you say, because they're like, we control the whaling. Mm. We control the whaling and everyone needs whale oil.
Yeah.
Because good luck if your citizens can't get their whale on toast. You know, they want to be able to spread that margarine on toast. That is Norway's projection of power.
Yeah.
And as you say, Alex, it disappears almost overnight when the war breaks out, because the Royal Navy now stop access to those areas anyway. And in that instant, Germany's reason to keep Norway around largely ends.
It's a peacetime critical capability, but it's a wartime ouch. And realistically, if the Germans could have been smart and tried to work through Norway to continue access to oils, etc., but the fact is, the British were going to make it more and more difficult. And the British policy, as they'd done in World War I, and the Germans knew this, was, okay, we have a neutral power who's doing a lot of whaling, and that whale oil could go to Germany. So we're just going to offer them more money. That was how the British enforced the blockade. This is what people forget about the British blockade in World War I. Part of it is physical ships. Part of it is literally rolling up with a check and going, how much are you prepared to pay? That plus whatever they offer him plus 100. And that's literally it. That's how the British do blockade. People often think British blockades are these offensive, nasty things, which are, you know, they're menacing people with guns. No, usually they're menacing people with checkbooks. That's how the British have done blockades for a long time. You know, when we were blockading France, there were entire islands of France which were off the coast, which would be quite happy when the Royal Navy showed up, because they would buy stuff. And so they would get supplies from France, and then they would sell them to the Royal Navy, and that's how the Royal Navy maintained its blockade. And it's the same in World War One. The British, which is one reason why the Germans, to be honest, the moment they go, there's no advantage to Norway staying neutral for them in that regard, because they know the British will just buy it off Norway. The British will just literally buy it off Norway. And if we consider the difference between Norway and Sweden, as you and I experienced when wandering around Sweden, and I think a few times we wandered into places, Sweden is one of these places which goes, right then, we are peaceful. But we are kind of peaceful where we have a huge stockpile sitting underneath that mountain buried down there, and we can get at it very quickly. You're never that far away from a strange door into a mountainside when you're wandering around Sweden. Now, forget which town we were in at one point, but it was the one where Alfred Nobel did a lot of his work. And we're just wandering around there going, there are a lot of tunnels into the mountains around here.
Yes, Karlskoga, isn't it?
Yes,
home of the place you can't fly drones over the lake, because it turns out Bofors have their factory on the opposite shore.
Yes.
But yeah, I mean, you're right. And I think, but I've really come back to this because I find this one, again, the reason I find this so fascinating, and it is one of those almost like horror once you know things of just, so much of this is just about margarine. It really is. Like, that is the primary driver. You know, yes, the military applications are there. Yes, they need them. But the need for that is on such a lower scale that you don't do the industrial stuff. Well, we'll link to it in the show notes. The German historian Ole Sparrenberg has done a lot of work looking at this and looking particularly at the involvement of Unilever in this, who are genuinely like, they are, in scale, whaling turns them almost into the East India Company size scale of control and political power in the 1930s. But I mean, Sparrenberg talks about how, like, there's a fantastic quote in one of his papers where he says, nothing has been more harmful to whales than the invention of margarine. Like, listeners, the scale of this is huge. In between 1936 and the outbreak of war in 1939, the combination of industrial activity by Unilever, Walter Rau, and Henkel, which is effectively the British, Norwegian, and German operations. Everyone is complicit in this, although Germany have come from nothing. And the Japanese, because the Japanese are whaling down there as well. That wipes out 90%, according to some estimates, of the entire blue whale population in the world in that 2-3 year period alone. Like, the outbreak of World War II quite literally saves multiple whale species because no one can go whaling anymore on that scale, which is insane.
You need the crews for other things. You need the crews for doing all sorts of different other things, but you can't have them going and doing that. And also, whaling fleets are something which are incredibly hard to protect and incredibly easy to try and track down on attack, because they have to follow the whales, which means they have to follow a predictable season. A Type 9 submarine could get down there and devastate a whaling fleet, and then you've lost all sorts of things. So what do you do?
And we should, and it's probably a good point, actually, like you say, like, I mean, the influence of whaling on that beginning period of World War II is fascinating as well, precisely because, as you say, it's not just the crews that end up being very useful resources to those whaling nations quickly, as in terms of combat sea and merchant sea roles, but also the ships. So one thing that happens the moment war does break out is Germany instantly repurposes its entire whaling fleets for other purposes. And those purposes are effectively for the hunting ships. Well, it turns out if you take that explosive harpoon gun off the front and stick on a dual purpose light gun and some machine guns, anti-aircraft
guns, it's a pretty good escort.
You now have. It's an incredibly good escort, particularly for operating in Norwegian waters, Norway, which you now no longer need to keep free and you're now kind of interested in yoinking. So most of those whaling ships spend the war as escort vessels up and down the Norwegian coast, including the ones that they capture off the Norwegians themselves. And meanwhile, in the UK, the whaling design of those ships gets repurposed as the Flower Class.
And also, you have Operation Claymore, which was the first commando operation of World War II, the first proper one. And that's carried out on the Lofoten Islands. And one of the reasons why they picked the Lofoten Islands was that is an area which has a large number of Norwegian harpooners. And they take off a huge number of Norwegian personnel off with them. They also managed to destroy 3,600 tons of fish oil factories and glycerine. And of course, fish oil factories, realistically in this period, mean mostly whale oil. There are a few other things, but, you know, that's what they were after. And they take up 314 Norwegian recruits, is what it's called. But let's be honest, a large chunk of those were the younger ones who were capable of operating harpoon guns and various other things, and getting them out of German hands was considered important.
And we should talk about, just in that run-up to war, what happens is you get two things happen. In 1937, you get a London Treaty, because even by then, even within that first period, it's realized that, like, this is not an infinite resource. We are pulling so many blue whales, and fin whales in particular, out of the ocean, that they're becoming harder to find already.
Yeah.
Like, if in 1937, the global powers are going, hang on, we should do some animal conservation, you know that they really, really did screw up. They know they screwed up. But that really doesn't make a huge dent. What it does do is it sets parameters and says, look, you can't overfish in areas. Like, stop taking the mothers out of the water. Mm-hmm. Now, how much this is actually enforced is open to question. Certainly, the evidence suggests that the German fleets in particular did not obey most of these rules, even though they technically signed up. But what this does create is a desire to find new whaling grounds. And that leads to, in 1938, to a renewed German interest, and Nazi interest in particular, because again, this is the ocean is our colony. You know, a renewed interest in Antarctic exploration, doesn't it?
And I also want to add in something about Unilever to give us a good example, because I've been checking the stats for Unilever, because I knew it from the top of my head, but I want to look it up and check my notes. So Unilever today is valued as having roughly 71 billion euros in assets. That is considered a quarter to what it reached in 1937. It was estimated at 280 billion. Its operating revenue and incomes were massive in those periods. But also, here's the thing. Today, it employs worldwide roughly 130,000 people. Roughly 130,000. In the 1930s, we're talking about an organization which was peaking at somewhere around 600,000. That puts it on the scale of the Indian National Railways. This was not a small organization. This was a massive organization. And this was on the back of whaling. This was on the back of the Lever brothers, who were the British soap maker, and also doing other things, merging with the Margarine Uni of the Dutch to make Unilever. And this company is only formed literally in 1930 with that merger. So it goes from being two quite large companies to being a massive company to being a astronomical company within about 7 years. All on the back of this. All on the back of all the money they're making.
And I know listeners, you're thinking that it can't be this. Like, how can something have happened on this scale that we just don't talk about now? It did. Like, I'll include links, extra links, all the studies on this.
The reason we don't talk about this, the reason we don't talk about a lot of things of history. We're embarrassed about it now.
Yeah, like literally, and again, like, we're focused on the German fleets here because that's of particular interest in this area. But this is a thing that everyone is doing.
Yeah,
like, everyone is involved in this. In 3 short years, and in those periods, those companies, like, unsurprisingly, you will not go onto the modern Unilever website under their sustainability section and find a paragraph about how they almost exterminated the vast majority of whales in the world.
The reason that Unilever decided to, rather, they didn't sell off their subsidiaries in the late 1930s and early 1940s, they just let them operate hands off, was because they were making so much money from the central thing, they could afford those things to go bankrupt and not bother about it. They really didn't care or want to bother with them. So they didn't sell them, they just let them running. And so things like, I think it was Lipton organization, which they ran in America, haven't had an American, still potentially have an America, they just left to their own devices. They were basically getting a blank check from Unilever because they had so much money, they wanted to spread money around to lower their tax bill. They were actually keeping conglomerates going, which were going bankrupt in the 1930s, to keep them going to spread out and reduce their tax bill to the British government. So, if you want another reason for history, and the reason it rhymes, but it's not the same, but it rhymes, again, major corporations doing major corporation things to reduce their tax bill.
And I think that's something I do think is worth thinking about, but taking away from this, listeners, is that we do sort of sometimes think about corporate behavior like this as a modern thing. It's not. Corporations have always done this. And just to be very clear, like, and we'll jump back a bit and talk about the Antarctic exploration in a second. But let's, just to be clear, we talk about post-war what happens, really. Like, post-war, you get a revival to a certain extent of whaling, but not to the same level.
Out
not least
about mid-1950s.
Ships aren't available.
Yeah,
mid-50s, you get it kicking back in again. Actually, most of the German naval fleet ends up, entirely unsurprisingly to anyone who's familiar with his corporate history, in the hands of Aristotle Onassis, who builds a brand new whaling industrial ship, the Olympic Challenger.
Actually, no. In his defense, whilst the ships had probably the health and safety standards of squat, he did actually give relatively high-paying roles because he wanted those experienced people. So it was actually quite a good job for post-war Germans who were looking to secure have a decent income. It was also one of the few jobs which they could really get to from wherever in Germany and could be employed by and could earn lots of money. Because, again, it was important to post-war Germany, both sides of the argument.
I think what you find interesting in the interviews I've read and I've seen with people who worked on the post-war whaling ships and side of things, and if you want to visit and see what one of these whalers was like, there is a preserved one actually at the Bremerhaven German Maritime Museum. It's worth visiting if people are in the area or find themselves in Bremen or Hamburg or whatever else. What you find is, and one of the reasons that Onassis is able to take control of most of the surviving German fleet, the German whaling fleet, is because what he agrees to do is he fits out in German yard. So as you say, he offers those jobs effectively, keeps them within Germany, keeps them doing that. And that makes it so it's a beneficial thing for him, but it's why he gets it cheap. And actually, if you're an average German sailor or worker working on those industrial fleets going out in post-war world, you're earning four times what a skilled worker will earn in 3 months of work. Like, it is key work. But what's also interesting in those interviews, I find, is because Onassis very, very much does not follow the basic rules laid down on the rules about whaling. He breaks all of the international treaties. It's also weirdly the point where most of those people working on those ships sit there and go, hang on, this isn't right. This isn't right. And you see the interviews with them now, and they all describe that post-war experience as being the one where they went, hang on, no, this isn't right, and I don't want to do it anymore. It's almost very similar to what you get with the West Africa squadron and slavery. Once those people start really experiencing the industry at its worst, they become almost the active people campaigning for it to stop. But we should just, before we get back to our Antarctic expedition, I just want to mention as well, because otherwise someone else will pull us up, is most of the major nations really stop whaling in that period. And that's partly because of the growth of vegetable oil as an alternative, a viable alternative for making margarine more than anything else. But it's also because the whale populations are so low. But what that does mean is late 1950s, right through to the 1980s, the people that sweep in and then almost finish off the elimination of all those whale species is the Soviets. The Soviets turn around and go, now we're going to get down there and have some fun. So when you get to your Star Trek films about Gracie the humpback whale being saved and all of those kind of things, the reason those humpbacks almost went extinct is because the Soviets spent a good 20 years down in the Antarctic after everyone else had largely stopped doing it.
But do you know why that was? Who started using vegetable oil and developed vegetable oil usage? It's Unilever. And do you know when they started the research that led to that? 1935, because they were worried about whale stocks. Oh no, officially because they were looking to diversify their support. So yes.
What I love about that is we're in a situation where Unilever were planning more for the loss of access to whale oil and global consequences than the nation of Norway.
Yes.
Which is why Unilever come out of the war largely unscathed and Norway doesn't.
Unilever are this great organization to look at because, okay, morally, ethically, they are always an interesting organization in terms of they always seem to be on the right side of history after it's happened. But, and I love them for that because they are quite shamelessly, they are a corporation and they're there to make a profit. And they are honest about that if you look at their history, and that's fine. I prefer honesty than people trying to cover themselves in things they're not. But the thing is, they're also the ones who are some of the most long-sighted. So they are starting to prepare for things running out long before. Always watch where Unilever is putting their research budget. Because usually they are about 10 to... By the time everyone else starts panicking, that's 10 to 15 years after Unilever's already been researching it.
I do feel like our chances of getting Unilever to sponsor this episode are rapidly decreasing. I think the chances of Nestle sponsoring it are rapidly rising, which is Nestle, you'd say, on the grounds of Nestle were evil, but at least we didn't almost make whales extinct.
Yes, but Nestle is another organization which is like Unilever in that they will be looking at it. If you look at what they're researching, they are 10 to 15 years ahead of everyone having a panic about something. They always are. And the person who got me onto this idea was actually a merchant banker who I know, who's very old. He's only retired this year after 40 years working in the banking industry. Before that, he did 20 years in the Royal Navy. So he worked a long, long time for his life, retiring at 80 from merchant banking. He's a really nice guy. But he basically said, yeah, it was the first thing I noticed because I'd been in naval intelligence. So I started looking at things and I looked at their research budget and I started putting the times together. And always, Unilever, Nestle, and there's a couple other companies, they're about 15 years ahead. If you want to really be prepared for the future, look at what these companies are researching now. 15 years later, everyone will be panicking about it. But don't worry, they will have a solution ready to go.
Well, let's finish the main part of this episode by looking back.
Before we start too many other conspiracy theories.
before Unilever find us. But let's talk a bit about, obviously, as we've talked about and as we touched on, by the time you hit 1937, 1938, the need to find new whaling grounds is growing. And particularly for Germany, the need to find and secure their own territory in Antarctica, so they're not dependent on access from other powers, is growing. And so what you get is you get a refreshed interest within the Nazi Party and within German military and in German Navy in expeditions to Antarctica. And that leads in 1938 to the decision that, right, we're going to go down there, we're going to find some territory down there that is unclaimed and we can call our own. And that leads to the Schwabenland expedition, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. This is this fun thing of also, they want it to be afterwards a great demonstration of German strength and German presence and German capability to project themselves around the world. Because it is seen as a new frontier for exploration. Think about it. At this point, they lost all their colonies post after World War I. They lost some of their colonies to the Japanese. Tsingtao, they lost to actual siege and taking by the Japanese. The first ever airstrike carried out by seaplanes and seaborne aircraft was carried out on Tsingtao, Monde Qingdao. And it's New Schwabia, or New Schwabenland, as it becomes, is this idea of, we can find this territory, we can secure territory, and it becomes our equivalent of South Georgia. There is a small problem. When you look at South Georgia on the globe, you'll notice where it is on the map. And then you look at where the Arctic, Antarctic is, and this lovely area covered in ice and snow and very, very cold. You see, South Georgia isn't that much better in terms of hospitality for human life. But it's just better enough it makes things practical. Where they were going in this period was not really practical. It was, how do I put this politely, about as inhospitable as you can think about operating in. And they take a lot of aircraft, they take a lot of ships, they take a lot of people to go and look at this stuff, and they are trying to map out an area, and realistically what they're mapping out for is they're looking for flat sites they can build stuff on. They're not looking at Antarctica as a resource venture in and of itself, although that is a long-term idea. They're looking at it as a place where they can set up the kind of facilities you find in South Georgia, the kind of facilities you find in the Falklands, the kind of facilities you find in Chile, the kind of facilities you find in Cape Town in South Africa, etc., which can support these fleets. And basically, places which they can set up, which are large enough that they can have large fuel tankers and other things coming down there, that they can have the large ships come down so that the whaling fleets can be down and be more productive for longer, more efficiently. There are two problems with this. One, pretty much everyone involved in German whaling knows exactly what's going on, which means all the companies, which means most of the other countries do know but can't necessarily prove it.
Oh, there's a fantastic story about how Norway find out.
Proves it. And I'm going to let you tell that story because you're far better at telling those sort of stories than I am.
So listen, as Alex says, like, ostensibly this is all being done under the window. This is scientific exploration.
Yeah.
So the MS Schwabenland is put into service to go down there. The expedition leader is a chap called Alfred Richer, who is a genuine polar explorer and scientist. He was a naval officer in both World Wars and actually flew reconnaissance planes in World War I. So he was uniquely qualified, almost with this skill set, to lead this expedition. And so they put him in charge of the expedition, and actually Goering signs off on the expedition getting a steam catapult installed on their ship and assigns them two Dornier DOJ-2 seaplanes. And again, this is an example of the visible approach to this and the sort of the, not secret, but the unspoken agenda. So the spoken agenda is scientific exploration. The seaplanes are going to fly deep inland into Antarctica, mapping new features. They find an entire mountain range that no one's ever found before. And they take over 11,000 photos, many of them in color, which are apparently like astonishing photos of Antarctica. The ones we survive are amazing. Sadly, it's a fraction of what existed. Like, most of them get destroyed in the war. But that's the ostensible surface level of this mission. But there are two goals beneath the surface. The real goal, as Alex has talked about already, is to turn around and go, how do we find somewhere down here we can claim as our own and we can set up a whaling station? And that's what they're looking for. They're flying out over the Antarctic inland. They find lakes, they find mountains, but as the ship's logs show, they find nowhere they can land. They can't get down there. They explore the coastline. They look for places they could maybe set up a harbor or a bay that's free of ice. They don't find them. But as all of this is happening, everyone in the industry kind of knows it's happening, but no one can prove it. But the way they're discovered and they're eventually found out is, I genuinely love how it happens, because effectively, the deputy expedition leader is a geologist called Ernst Hermann. And obviously his wife is at home. His wife is back at home. Now, Ernst Hermann is a good geologist. He's a well-known geologist. He works with lots of other geologists. And so it's not unusual that one day a Norwegian geologist called Adolf Hoel rings his house. And obviously he's not there. He's away. So Hoel naturally asks his wife where Ernst is. And she's, oh, Ernst is down in the Antarctic on this German expedition. And so Hull's, oh, well, what's that expedition about? What's its purpose? And she's, oh, well, they're looking for new whaling stations and all that kind of thing. And which Hull goes, oh, that's cool. That's really, really, really. Hangs up, immediately contacts the Norwegian government, says, I've got proof that the Germans are trying to set up an Antarctic base. And then just the Norwegian government instantly lodges a claim to all of that territory that the Germans are exploring, because it borders Queen Maud Land, which is the territory they already control. Which is, it's just that classic thing of like, if you're going to go on a secret, an expedition that has secret goals, make sure your wife back home knows that some of those goals are secret, or she might tell the Norwegians about it.
This is fun. They've done a lot of hunting. They've done a lot of interesting work, but also they had picked the area they were going, so they'd be nowhere near where the British claim was. And nowhere near what was other claims from other British-supported powers, because they're worried because British cruisers were a far more common thing. That's why they picked the area which was right next towards the Norwegian area. Because they thought the Norwegians won't have a warship down there, because as we talked about, the Norwegians aren't investigative. No, Norwegians aren't, but they are very keen on their whaling. Now, it's just... It's a beautiful piece of scenario where you sit there and go, okay, so no one told the wife. But also, here's the thing. Weren't the Norwegians lucky to have someone who was not only known to the gentleman involved, but also knew his wife well enough that she was going to open up to and talk to completely? Someone whose research was funded by many various interests and various interesting multinational corporations on occasion for his geological research.
Oh yeah, it's all wonderfully just pure low level obvious corporate espionage and national espionage, and I do love it. But we should talk a bit about, so the expedition itself is very successful. It's genuinely successful. They survey about 600,000 kilometers of unsurveyed territory. And actually, again, as a sign of that this is a geopolitical exercise in claiming as much as anything else, is when those aircraft are flying out, those seaplanes are flying out, they have on board these kind of giant swastikas on arrows. And the theory is that they're just going to drop these as far inland in this Antarctic territory as they can, in order to ensure that they can kind of go, Germany was here, and then claim it when they get back. Now, you'll read lots of accounts online, listeners, of loads of these arrows being dropped everywhere. And most of it is not, and we'll come on to why some of this stuff gets exaggerated right at the end of the show. But they do drop one. So one is dropped, and it is left there. And this is a genuine exercise to try and mark out a claim and go, look, we've explored this area that no one's explored before. That means we have a legal right to claim it.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, by the time they get back, even though the expedition is incredibly successful, and actually, again, there is a slight military element to this, as we've talked about, in that even on the way back, they actually stop off at the, I think it's the Trinidad and Martin Vaz Islands, because they've used them in World War I as places to hide whilst you're refueling U-boats. And there is a genuine thought about, well, can we do that again? Let's do some surveying in there, just in case. So they do that on the way back. One of the reasons Goering has given them seaplanes is because, you know, let's make sure these planes can operate in icy conditions. We might need them to operate in icy conditions in the future. But they get back. They discover that the Norwegians have already lodged a claim. They do plan a second expedition. But before they can go anywhere, World War II breaks out. And the rest, as they say, is history.
Yeah.
But I just, as we wrap up, for regular listeners, I do find it fascinating. And we'll include links to various bits about this and good papers on this in the show notes. But I really want to come back to, like, there's this entire forgotten history here of this genuinely brief period, like those late 30s, where humanity is driving whales almost to extinction in a very short period of time. And we're doing it primarily four companies that are doing it in cooperation and obviously desire from the market and state. But it's all primarily for the purpose of coming up with of creating margarine. We just don't think about that today at all.
No, but it's not also, again, nothing unusual for humanity, because we've been driving things extinct for our needs quite a lot over the years. You know, it's something new when we start going, hang on, we're actually caretakers of this world, not its owners. And therefore, we need to preserve some things, you know, there are whole species of birds. There are potentially species of whales. There are potentially species of whales, which we don't know about, because they were all driven to extinction a long time ago. It's one of the big species which suffered a lot during the whaling times was, of course, the basking shark, because that was quite often mistaken for a whale and was taken out. And then I went, oh, you got a basking shark again. Oh, well, you know, there are all sorts of damage done. But also, one of the other legacies of this period, etc., was, and it's hard to sort of phrase this, it's actually a lot of the stuff which was done to refine our knowledge and understanding of the whales so we could better target them has actually proved very useful longer term now in monitoring their populations, in helping expand, in understanding. It's amazing the amount of data we actually gathered while we were trying to kill them. And that data has proved useful.
It's a small light at the end of the tunnel.
It's a very, very small light.
Very, very small light.
Very small light. But it is there.
And so listeners, regular listeners, thanks very much for listening. Alex, thanks for joining me in this. I mentioned at the top of the show, where can people find you if they want to know more about you? Where can Unilever find you if they're trying to find you?
I have a YouTube channel. It's called Dr. Alex Clark. It was originally set up during COVID as somewhere for my students to find me. And I've left the doctor there because there is an extremely successful YouTuber called Alex Clark. And whilst I find her a very fun lady, she's very committed to her content. I don't want to be confused with her on my own YouTube channel. So I just went, I'm going to leave the doctor there. I do get comments from people going, why are you going on with your doctor? I'm sort of going, type Alex Clark into YouTube. You'll find out why I've left the doctor there very quickly.
And so, listeners, what you'll find on Alex's channel is lots of excellent naval history. He, like me, he does some video game streaming. If you're interested in watching colonies of beavers build large empires, Alex will often be doing that on Twitch, yeah. But so, I mean, and again, listeners, if you've enjoyed this, do like, subscribe, share the word, spread. Don't forget, if you go to untitled-history.com, you can sign up, you can join, you can buy merch these days, and you will get access to the extra bit, which is what Alex and I are now going to talk about. Because one of the things that is a long-term legacy of this whole fascination the Nazis have with Antarctica is it creates these massively long-running conspiracy theories about there being a massive secret Nazi base in Antarctica, doesn't it?
Well, that's the original conspiracy behind Operation...
You've been listening to the Untitled History Podcast, a Battle Guide production. If you've enjoyed this episode and would like to support the podcast, why not head over to our dedicated supporter page? There, for the cost of a cup of tea, you can decide which subjects we cover next, get access to exclusive behind-the-scenes content, and join a community of like-minded people. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.